Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the Institute, and I have great pleasure in welcoming you to this public event on engaging the Muslim world, challenges and opportunities. Congressman Keith Ellison, who was scheduled to open this event with a keynote address, is delayed due to unavoidable commitments on Capitol Hill. We expect him to arrive between 10:15 and 10:30. Consequently, we have adapted the program to accommodate the congressman's schedule. So we will begin with presentations by the other speakers and will break when the congressman arrives. So that said, we can proceed. In the aftermath of the September 11 terrorist attacks, the Institute launched the Muslim World Initiative to address the vital foreign policy and national security challenges associated with the many and diverse Islamic societies around the globe. We are focused on three cross-cutting themes: how to mobilize moderate leaders and publics, how to marginalize militants and extremist elements, and how to bridge the divide between the United States and the Muslim world. One of the fruits of this initiative is the volume Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World, Challenges for U.S. Engagement, edited by Daniel Broomberg and Dina Shihata, which we're proud to launch today. This volume echoes all of the Muslim world's initiative's themes, but approaches them in a unique manner. It evaluates the evolution of U.S.-Muslim relations in the context of conflicts within the Muslim world over identity, society, ideology, and politics. Although this volume was not specifically designed as a policy blueprint, it offers important lessons and insights for the U.S. administration, elucidating the complex interplay of U.S.-Muslim relations and conflicts within the Muslim world. These insights apply not only to Iraq, but more broadly to the Middle East, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. Let me now introduce the speakers in the order in which they will speak. Their biographies have been distributed, they're out in front, so I will be brief. Daniel Broomberg is acting director of the Institute's Muslim World Initiative in the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention and an associate professor of government at Georgetown University. Dan is also the volume's co-editor and will give an overview of the book and address the question of engagement. Dina Shihata is a senior researcher at Al Aram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo and former special advisor to the Muslim World Initiative. She is the book's co-editor and will discuss Islamist secularist dynamics in Egypt. And if the congressman, as we hope, arrives after the first two presentations by Dan and Dina Shihata, then the congressman's remarks will be followed by a commentary by David Smock, who is vice president of the Institute Center for Mediation and Conflict Resolution and leads the Center of Innovation on Religion and Peacemaking. He's also a contributor to the edited volume, and as I said, he will serve as a commentator following Congressman Ellison's remarks and will address the question of interfaith dialogue. Umut Tazpinar is a non-resident fellow and director of the U.S.-Turkey Project at the Brookings Institution, and he will speak on Islamist secular dynamics in Turkey and implications for U.S.-Turkey relations. And of course, last but by no means the least, Palwasha Hassan is a Jennings Randall Fellow at the Institute. She is also country director for rights and democracy in Afghanistan, and she will address the impact of U.S. economic aid on the role of women's groups in Afghanistan. So, Dan, you have the podium.
Well, good morning, and thanks to everyone on this panel and at USIP who helped set up this event. I just want to say a few words about the book we are launching today. When I was asked some 2 years ago to compile and edit a collection of articles and reports that would represent the vast range of work and writing about the Muslim world undertaken by USIP staff and grantees, I recognized that this would be a daunting project. But as more for the purposes of producing a volume that policymakers, regional specialists, and students would find interesting and useful, I recognized that my challenge was to select material around which we could build an analytical center of gravity. Working with my colleague, Dr. Dina Shahata, I think we've done just that, and in a manner that is both compelling and timely. So let me just say a few words about the book itself. I have five essential themes, and that really doesn't cover the entire book, but I think it reflects the basic core. First, this book tackles the phenomenon of engagement in a far more expansive and multidimensional sense than is commonly understood, particularly in the diplomatic world. By engagement, we mean a multitude of programs, initiatives, and actions that government leaders, religious figures, civil society activists, writers, and others have adopted to address a diverse range of concerns, apprehensions, and so on that in recent years have framed the relations between the United States and Muslim-majority societies. This use of the term engagement has much in common with the multidimensional vision that President Obama outlined during his June Cairo speech. That said, and as Abby mentioned, this book was not written in any strict sense as a policy guide for any particular administration. Digging deeper, it was hoped that we would highlight a range of complicated, overlapping challenges that emerged in the wake of 9/11 and the ensuing invasion of Iraq, challenges which we believe will endure well into the future. Two, one of these challenges is the escalation of identity conflicts within and between Muslim-majority states. On the one hand, and the direct or indirect involvement of the United States, both officially and unofficially, in addressing, dealing with, and sometimes exacerbating these identity conflicts. This is a complex problem that has not, in fact, received much systematic attention. But as the examples of Iraq in particular, along with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Yemen, Morocco, Egypt, and others demonstrate, U.S. foreign policy has now become intertwined in domestic and regional identity conflicts of all kinds, between Shiites and Sunnis, between Islamists and non-Islamists, between ethnic groups such as the Kurds and Berbers and nationalist or Islamist actors. These processes have been, in many ways, unprecedented. Many of the chapters in this book address various facets of this complex overlapping dynamic as they have played out in Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkey, Egypt, Yemen, Somalia, and the Sudan. Three, in analyzing these dynamics, this book proceeds from the proposition that political and social conflicts, and even so-called identity conflicts in Muslim-majority states, are not expressions of some Muslim heritage or the articulation of some essential aspects of the Muslim faith. Indeed, and as I and other contributors in this book argue, because identity cleavages and conflicts in the Muslim-majority states are often framed in ideological, ethnic, or social terms that have little to do with Islam, policies that proceed from the premise that Islam is the essence of the problem or even the heart of the solution will be misguided and counterproductive. This conclusion, of course, has important implications for how we pursue an engagement strategy with a so-called Muslim world that cannot be defined or understood strictly in religious terms. Four, that said, because the issue of the Islamic faith is hardly irrelevant, and because to varying degrees and in various ways it does enter into the equation, the various analyses in this book tackle the problem of conflict, identity, and engagement from a variety of disciplinary and analytical perspectives. These perspectives include analyses of efforts to reinterpret Islamic texts to support nonviolent forms of conflict resolution, accounts of interfaith dialogues and the role that American Muslim leaders and organizations have played in these dialogues, and case studies of grassroots initiatives, some of which the USIP has supported or has been directly involved in promoting Islamist secular or Islamist non-Islamist dialogues, and more ambitiously in promoting or failing to promote formal power-sharing arrangements in countries such as diverse as Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The introductory essay that I have written with Dr. Shahata provides a comprehensive overview of all these themes, while delving in particular into the comparative problems and dilemmas of promoting democratic power sharing. Five, and finally, this book reflects, and sometimes dissects, the many dilemmas and challenges that flow from the efforts of both U.S. officials and non-governmental organizations to walk a fine line between objective analysis and advocacy. I imagine that my fellow USIP colleagues would acknowledge that we are most familiar with this challenge. Indeed, as Dr. Shahada and I have noted in the introduction, USIP staff is involved in both analyzing and trying to resolve problems. These two dynamics do not always fit easily together, particularly when analytical conclusions do not always go hand in hand with our most passionate commitments. This tension between advocacy and analysis was a central theme that animated and also undermined the U.S. effort in Iraq. But this tension is manifest in many arenas. I think we do a pretty good job of wrestling with it at USIP, and hopefully this collection of essays will suggest useful lessons for linking theory and practice in ways that advance conflict resolution within Muslim-majority societies and between those societies and the United States. Thank you very much.
Good morning, and I'd like to extend my thanks to the USIP for giving me this opportunity to come to Cairo from Cairo and to participate in this event. My talk is going to fit in nicely with Dan's presentation. It kind of contextualizes it in the Egyptian context by looking at how conflict over identity and over foundational issues between Islamists and non-Islamists or secularists in the Egyptian opposition have constituted one of the principal sources, I argue, in the paper that I have in this book, but also in a book that I will have published by the end of this year. It has constituted one of the principal sources of the durability of authoritarianism, both in Egypt and also elsewhere in the Arab world. This ideological divide between Islamists and secularists over a number of foundational issues has helped keep the Egyptian opposition weak and fragmented, and has, on the other hand, also reinforced the cohesion of the ruling regime or the ruling coalition. Regime cohesion in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world is not simply a function of the existence of a radical alternative or the strength of the Islamist opposition. It also has structural underpinnings. One of them has to do with the continued ability of these regimes to extend patronage to important social groups, such as, you know, the civil service. Egypt, for example, the Egyptian state, for example, employs 6 million people. So that's a big chunk of the Egyptian labor force that works directly for the government. The business elite in Egypt is also closely allied with the ruling regime, and there are mutual interests that maintain this alliance. And up until recently, the laborers or working force in Egypt was also a principal constituency of the regime. That has changed in the past 20 years, and we'll discuss it a little bit further on in this talk. And also, the regime is able to rely on repression to maintain those it is not directly allied with under control. So this dual use of patronage and repression is one of the main pillars of regime stability. But on the other hand, there is also another source that maintains elite cohesion in Egypt, and that's the lack of a moderate alternative. And that maintains a number of groups who would otherwise support democratization in Egypt aligned to the ruling coalition. So, for example, the new middle class that works for the private sector, youth in Egypt, private sector workers, all of these groups could potentially constitute a constituency for a moderate alternative to the regime. But for the time being, given that the only alternative is the Islamist one or the only organized alternative, they seem to be continue to align themselves with the regime. The same for the Christian minority in Egypt and also for a number of women's groups. The regime is aware that this situation plays to its advantage, and it kind of capitalizes on it. And this was most recently demonstrated in the past elections, where the Brotherhood was able to win 20% of the seats, and the secular opposition won less than 2% of the seats. And, you know, while this may not have been a completely deliberate outcome, I think the regime itself was surprised, even the Brotherhood was surprised by their success in the elections. I think the regime realizes that this is a mutually beneficial situation and reinforces it and makes sure that the moderate opposition, both within the Islamist camp and the secular camp, remains weak. So, for example, Ayman Noor, who founded the Ghad Party and who promised to, you know, lead a movement that could reinvigorate the opposition, at one point was subjected to a severe repression. Similarly, with the moderate groups within the Islamist opposition, like Al-Wasat Party, this is a group that split it from the Brotherhood in 96 and has been trying up until this day to constitute or to institute a political party and is prevented from doing so by the regime. So I think there's a realization that this situation is useful and perpetuates the status quo. And I think opposition actors in Egypt are aware of this, which raises the question, why do they not try to transcend what, you know, Dan has called in the book this mutually harmful stalemate? If they realize that their own fragmentation and divisions perpetuates the status quo, why do they not do more to try to change that situation? I think there are three principal reasons why this is the case. One of them has to do with lingering polarization over some deep and foundational values or issues. One of them has to do with the role of religion in the political system, the Sharia, who has the right to interpret it, and how does it factor into the legislative process. Questions of equal citizenship, the rights of women and minorities, continue to be very controversial issues in the debate between Islamists and secularists, and this was most recently demonstrated in 2007 when the Brotherhood issued a hugely controversial document that highlighted these deep divisions over these foundational issues that have to do with the nature of the political system. And in spite of, you know, the fact that there are these deep divisions and they have persisted for decades now, there has also been, on the other hand of the equation, a consensus over procedural democracy, in the sense that you find that Brotherhood leaders and opposition and leaders from the secular opposition have participated in a number of initiatives and issued a number of common declarations that call for freedom of association, for removing restraints on NGOs, political parties, professional syndicates, for free and fair elections. And, you know, since the 1980s, there have been tens of these kinds of initiatives and declarations, which I discuss in my book on alliance building between Islamists and secularists. However, most of these initiatives have not really tackled the real divisions between Islamists and secularists in Egypt. And there was one attempt in 94 to discuss these divisive issues. It was the National Consensus Project, and this was one of the few initiatives that tried to initiate an honest dialogue about the deep divides, and unfortunately it failed because they couldn't come to an agreement. So over and above the divisions between Islamists and secularists, you also have deep divisions within each of these camps. So within the Brotherhood and within the Islamist opposition, there are also divisions between hardliners and moderates, between different generations that espouse different viewpoints. Similarly, in the secular opposition, you have divisions between liberals, nationalists, leftists, also between different generations within the opposition. So you find a great deal of fragmentation, particularly in the secular opposition, over ideational and ideological issues. So on the one hand, the ideological issue is very divisive, but also on the other hand, there is a deep imbalance in power between Islamists and secularists in Egypt, which feeds into the polarization between them. Islamists have tended to be better organized and united than their secularist counterparts. This has partly to do with the ethic of the movement, which emphasizes hierarchy and obedience to elders and so forth, but also it has to do with the state of siege that the Brotherhood has been under since it was reconstituted in the 1970s. The reason why the secular opposition is also much weaker than the Brotherhood has to do with the internal fragmentation of secularists in Egypt along ideological, tactical, generational lines, and also because many of the important social groups who could potentially constitute a support base for the secular opposition continue to be allied with the regime. The secular opposition has not succeeded up until this moment of attracting trade unionists or the bourgeoisie or women's movements or Christians away from the ruling coalition. So in a sense, it's a vicious cycle because, you know, they remain weak because they cannot attract them, but also these groups continue to be aligned with the regime because they perceive the secular opposition as unable to compete effectively with Islamists. The third factor that perpetuates the situation has to do with the successful use of divide-and-rule strategies by the ruling regime. The Egyptian regime and other regimes in the Arab world have been hugely successful in manipulating and perpetuating this divide. The regime constantly extends incentives to select groups in the opposition to ensure that no broad-based alliance is emerged to successfully challenge the regime. So the opposition leaders are given, you know, seats in parliament, financial incentives, they appear in the media, they have access to high-ranking policymakers, and that, you know, keeps them moderately satisfied with the status quo. A few propositions about how best to move beyond mutually harmful stalemate, and they build on the theme of the book, whether it's about ideological convergence or really about institutional reform. On the one hand, you know, small steps have been made over the years to bring Islamists and seculars closer together towards a democratic consensus or a convergence on a democratic agenda. But still, you know, I think since the 1980s until the present moment, no breakthroughs have happened to bridge this gap. And I think this has more to do with this, you know, the stagnant political situation in Egypt. And unless, you know, there are real changes in the structural and institutional framework, it's unlikely that this kind of genuine convergence or consensus is going to emerge. And I think, you know, what we need to see is a shift in the balance of power between these two actors. This could happen if the Brotherhood becomes a more divided movement, if the moderate wing of the movement splits off as it has done in Turkey, for example, and constitutes or establishes a separate party or movement. But given the state of siege that the Brotherhood is under, this has not happened. Another alternative is for the secular opposition to become more cohesive and stronger, and there are indications that there is an opportunity for it to do so. For the first time in a very long time, we're seeing now in Egypt the resurgence of a workers' movement. The bourgeoisie is becoming a very important actor. Youth are becoming more mobilized. You're hearing about bloggers and different protest movements led by youth. Up until now, the secular opposition has not had the sufficient leadership skill to try to link up with these new constituencies. But I think they provide a very good opportunity for the secular opposition in Egypt, especially the left, to renew their ranks. But we're still waiting for, you know, the right leadership to bridge this gap between these new movements and the political parties and political movements. One final point about the potential role of external actors in this dynamic. There are, I think, three things that could be done by external actors to help bridge the gap between different groups within the Egyptian opposition and elsewhere in the Arab world. Engaging moderates and giving them an umbrella of protection could be helpful, even though in the case of Ayman Nour that wasn't necessarily very successful. But I think it's important when the U.S. administration engages with opposition actors that it tries to privilege more moderate voices, both within the Islamist and the non-Islamist opposition. Also pushing for continued socio-economic change. I think the reason why we're seeing a great deal of new movements and new types of mobilization in Egypt today is because Egyptian society has changed a great deal over the past 20 years as a result of important economic transformations. So I think, you know, the continuation of this process is likely to free up new constituencies that were previously controlled by the regime. A final point is about the regional situation. I think, you know, having a more peaceful and secure regional order is likely to significantly reduce polarization between different groups in the Egyptian opposition and elsewhere also in the Arab world. Thank you very much.
Good morning, and thank you also to the U.S. Institute of Peace for inviting me. What I'd like to do is to briefly address the question of polarization in Turkey between Islam and secularism. And this requires, unavoidably, a certain understanding of Turkey's identity question, identity problems. I think of all the countries in the Islamic world, it's fair to say Turkey is probably the most polarized in terms of its identity. And there's an easy way of explaining this by focusing on Islam versus secularism. However, I think a perhaps more accurate way of understanding the polarization in Turkey would be to look at this identity dilemma of Turkey, which is not really about Islam and secularism, but about the problems of democratization. And in many ways, one can argue that the polarization in Turkey is about a power struggle between the old secularist Kemalist elite and a new elite that is emerging, especially in the Anatolian periphery, a conservative elite that is more pious, more traditional, more conservative, and that has now economic power. What differs, I think, Turkey from a number of countries in the Islamic world is that it's a capitalistic country. The dynamics in the Turkish economy are very private sector oriented, and you have a new bourgeoisie now in Turkey, a new middle class, a new business community that actually wants to have its share of power. So one way of looking at the Justice and Development Party, which is often labeled as a mildly moderately Islamic party, is to understand the class dynamics behind this political party and to look basically at the new bourgeoisie in Anatolia, the Anatolian Tigers, these small and medium-sized companies that are actually voting for AK Party and support this conservative party. So this political dimension, I think, is as important as the Islam versus secularism dimension in Turkish politics. What is the Justice and Development Party about? What is its agenda? Well, again, it depends on who you ask in Turkey. Turkey is very polarized. There is a lack of trust in Turkey among different political parties. And if you ask the opposition, the secularist Republican People's Party opposition, which represents more or less the Kemalist elite in Turkey, the secularist, more nationalist elite, they believe that this is a political party that has a plan to Islamize Turkey and that they're not to be trusted, that we should not be fooled by the fact that this political party is pushing for democratic reforms or that it's pushing for a pro-European Union agenda, because they are engaged in what they ironically call the secularists call takiya, which is this dissimulation. You don't show your real colors until you really have power and establish yourself, and then you go for the big Islamization drive. So the secularists in Turkey are very much concerned about this slow Islamization under the garb of democratization, pro-EU reforms, that basically the safeguards of Turkish secularism are eroding, that Kemalism is eroding, that the Turkish military is losing power as the guardian of Turkish secularism and official ideology of the Republic, Kemalism as we know it. Now, there's a certain irony here as well, because the Justice and Development Party is the fourth incarnation of political Islam in Turkey. And when you look at the three previous political parties, you see that they were all more radical Islamic parties. The first one, the Nationalist Order Party of Erbakan, which was banned twice and reopened in the 1990s as with the name of Welfare Party, was basically like the Muslim Brotherhood wing of the Turkish political Islam. It was a pretty very much Islamic political party. Yet what happened in 1997, in my opinion, the fact that the military decided to put a stop on Erbakan's rise, he was the prime minister in 1997 in a coalition government, changed the nature of political Islam in Turkey. There was a kind of identity crisis, a kind of existentialist crisis within the political Islamic movement, and a new guard, a more pragmatic, younger, more reformist guard emerged. And those are the people who are empowered in Turkey today. Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister, was the mayor of Istanbul. In the late 1990s, he had to spend 4 months in jail after the military coup. Basically, this gives you time to rethink about what you want to do in politics. So and Abdullah Gül, who was also part of the Young Guard and who is now the president, also is a pragmatic force. So what reemerged in 2001 to win the elections in 2002, the Justice Development Party, is a much more pragmatic animal compared to the Welfare Party. They are pro-EU. They are pro-market. They pay lip service to democracy. They appear to be pro-democracy, yet they share the illiberal tendencies of all Turkish political parties and Turkish political culture and the Turkish political system as well. So to call this a fight between Democrats, the AK Party, and the authoritarian, the secularists, the Kemalists, I think is an oversimplification, because we don't have really a democracy versus anti-democracy situation. We have a power struggle, in my opinion, in Turkey between basically two clashing ideologies, two clashing worldviews, two clashing power elites and classes. A new elite is emerging, and it remains to be seen to what degree this transition will be peaceful. The military is often concerned about Islamization. Is there a risk of another military coup in Turkey? I think the times of basically old-style military coups with tanks in the street and politicians jailed or hanged are over in Turkey. We have come too far in terms of a changed society, a society that is more demanding of democratic standards. But a new type of military intervention where either the military or the judiciary, which is another bastion of secularism, which is also changing, those are complex dynamics, could try to ban the political party as they tried to do in 2008. Ironically, right after the political party, Justice and Development, had won the elections with a landslide with 47%. A few months after that election, that landslide victory, the Constitutional Court and the Chief Prosecutor of the Republic had an indictment which wanted to ban the political party in power on the grounds that they have an Islamic agenda. Now, what is this Islamic agenda? And that's also where Turkey differs from the rest of the Islamic world. When you ask Islamists in Turkey, what do you want in terms of your political agenda? The answer that they give very often is about headscarves. They want Turkish girls, women, to be able to go to universities with headscarves. Now, that may sound very innocuous in an American context, but it does not in the French context, for instance. Therefore, we need to understand the nature of Turkish secularism. Turkish secularism is very alarmist about religion and considers Islam as the problem, in fact. It considers Islam as the real reason why the Ottoman Empire declined and wants to have a certain level of control over Islam. We call Turkey a very secular country, but in fact there is an institution called the Directorate of Religious Affairs which controls Islam in Turkey to this day and is very concerned about letting loose the Islamic dynamics in the country. So the headscarf issue is polarizing for Turkey. Abdullah Gül, the foreign minister who became president, is married to a lady with the headscarf, and that basically turned into a major debate in Turkey, which polarized the country, and the military came at the brink of a coup because they did not want to see the first lady of the country as a headscarf woman, because that fights the symbolism of the country as a secular republic. The fact that most of the cabinet members of AK Party, probably 90% of them, are married to women with headscarves also creates this fear of Islamization. So symbols are important. It may sound very innocuous as a symbol, the headscarf, but it is polarizing Turkey. Now, also because of this distrust of Takiya, there is a sense that the headscarf is just the beginning of the end, that's how it starts. But later on, they will implement their agenda, which is about banning alcohol, changing lifestyles, and slowly Islamizing the country. So there is a certain level of alarm, distrust, depending on where you are. You can call it paranoia in Turkey. Now, finally, to conclude, what are the implications for the United States? Well, I think it's very interesting that after 9/11, the U.S. was trying hard to look for countries that could challenge the thesis of a clash of civilizations. It was very important for the United States not to appear in war with Islam, that the war against terrorism, the concept that now we're no longer using, that basically that war should not be against Islam, should not be perceived as such, because it would only fuel the clash of civilization, the Huntingtonian thesis. So there was an attempt to look in the Islamic world and find Muslim, pro-Western, secular, and democratic countries. Muslim, pro-Western, secular, and democratic countries. And there were not many. Turkey qualified immediately, stood out, and a NATO member trying to become a member of the European Union, secular, democratic, and definitely Muslim. 99.5% of Turkey is Muslim, unlike Egypt, by the way. We don't have a Christian minority. And there was this talk about a Turkish model, especially among the neoconservatives. Paul Wolfowitz was the first to argue that there should be a Turkish model. And ironically, that idea of a Turkish model totally backfired in the country that was supposed to become the model, Turkey. Today, there's a perception that the Islamists, moderate as they are in Turkey, are basically pet projects of America's plan to create a moderate Islam in Turkey, that basically they are sponsored by the United States, that this is Washington's plan to create good Muslims against the bad Muslims, that Turks would be the good Muslims. So there's this perception of political Islam in Turkey as a made-in-the-USA project, among secularists, among radical secularists especially. That's, of course, a conspiracy theory, but perception matters. And that's what we have in Turkey. And ironically, Turkey, of course, was not accepted as a model by the Arab world because basically Turkey was considered too alien, a country that has turned its back to Islam, a country that no longer really cherishes its Islamic heritage. But today what we see is a very paradoxical dynamic. And again, there's an irony here. Turkey is becoming a model for the Islamic world, not because of what the United States wanted, this pro-Western, secular, democratic credentials, but because Turkey said no to the United States in Iraq. That basically endeared Turkey to the Arab world, the perception that Turkey was able to stand up and say no to the invasion of Iraq and close its borders, did not allow American troops and that was the parliament's decision. I would argue it was an accident of history, but now it's perceived as a big victory for Turkey. And second, Turkey is very vocal in its criticism of Israel. The relations between Turkey and Israel are going south, and this is also a product of, in my opinion, not Islamization in Turkey, but public opinion becoming more important in Turkey. This government in charge looks at public opinion. And Turkey is not becoming more Islamic, I would conclude with this, but it's becoming more nationalist, more angry towards the especially the European Union. Turkey feels humiliated by the European Union, and this increasingly turns into a kind of nationalist sentiment. And in that sense, we should follow, I think, what is the big trend in Turkey, which is nationalism, not Islamization. And Turkey has indeed become a model for the Middle East, for the Arab world, or the larger Islamic world, I would argue. But that's not exactly for the reasons that the United States wanted.
Good morning. Today's talk... I am supposed to talk about U.S. policies' impact on women's self-growing movement. While the actual topic was eight policies, but my reflection will be on U.S. policy in general, encompasses the eight as well. I would like to explore this topic from the opportunities and challenges from a women perspective in Afghanistan over a period of the Cold War to the present era of discourses, of policy discourses of peace settlement in Afghanistan with insurgents. As you know, foreign aid since its expansion in the 60s has been driven by foreign policies, objective and military intervention of donor countries. If one looks to the Cold War era, The recent discourses of peace settlement and negotiation with so-called moderate Taliban and insurgent groups, one see drastic fluctuation in last 30 years, the way U.S. interest has varied from winning Cold War objective to the counter-terrorism and counter-insurgencies. The socio-political climate as a result of these policies had direct impact on women's self-growth and empowerment and women's repression and regression on the other hand. In the years of the Cold War, U.S. policy has enhanced the role of conservatives and religious groups, who in turn have limited women's role in the societies to traditional spaces, confining them more to households activities and introducing more restrictive rules on veiling of women, following the Islamic patterns of Saudi Arabia and other countries who has been allies of U.S. In the Cold War era. The challenges for women has magnified with conservatism in already traditional conservative environment. However, as it is said, that where there is oppression, there is resilience. In absences of state-run apparatus and support mechanism, women has learned how to work around the traditional barriers and look to find new ways of helping themselves and women and children. And they started to work more on activities which were less controversial, for instance, opening clinics, schools, and areas where centers where they usually use as Quranic lessons, but in meanwhile, it was like spreading literacies among women. In post-Taliban era, there has been a drastic improvement from the previous regime in the status of women. However, this had also had its own pitfalls. The aid flow which comes to Afghanistan after so many years of neglect of situation of people in general and women specifically, because in Taliban era there has been long years where women suffered under a regime where there have been total ban on women and public participation. Suddenly, the flow of aid and attention has started to women. And this has brought new changes and new opportunities also for women. On one hand, there has been a women agenda has been centered through the Bonn Agreement, which brought the new political regime and changes in Afghanistan. On the other hand, the flow of aid has helped women groups, which has been established during the Cold War era, to grow to more national NGOs. And using these fundings, women has been able to expand their activities from small circles to reach provinces, and especially more of the provinces where the reach of other organizations has been difficult. And in meanwhile, women in this time has been ready, in contrast to the usual emancipation of women historically in Afghanistan, where the changes has been top down and there hasn't been enough readiness in the community to accept the changes. In this time, women has been able to occupy the position which has been offered through these political new opportunities. Some of the projects I would like to give as an example of this new emerging opportunities, which has increased women constituency within the Afghan communities, help them with building trust with the communities, and communities also trusting women for their leadership role, was, for instance, the example of the accelerated education program or project which was run, supported or sponsored by USAID in Afghanistan, and a woman organization has been contracted as part of the larger partners, which is usually the partnership of the aid. Unfortunately, for big project is helped or partnership is held between the organization held under main leadership. In this project, there have been a few groups which were led by women, and this has helped increase or support of education for around 10,000 children in one of the most conservative provinces, which is called Paktia province. And 50% of the beneficiaries or the children of this project has been girls who has been able to reach level 6 of the school within 2 years program. The same organization through building this kind of trust with the communities and relation with the community has been able to play a role in the election of 2004 and also 2007 using this kind of relation. So this, I would argue, has helped transforming the role of women organization from delivering services to helping in voice and women, bringing women into the decision-making process of the country. However, there have been also challenges to it, especially when the aid and support of Afghanistan women were framed in the larger policy picture, flagging Afghan women liberation as one of the justification for the war in Afghanistan. This has increased resentment and created backlash against women in society where notion of honor is centered on control and protection of women in certain cultural parameters. Even words such as gender has created a reaction by implementers in the government and also in the parliament. Often very legitimate recommendation by women, which was discussed in the parliament without there being a clear reason and going against religion, is perceived to be anti-religion or something which is bringing an, a Western agenda. And women leaders has been perceived leaders as an agents from the U.S. government or Western societies. This kind of like multiple the magnitude of resistance and understanding between the religious and conservative groups were in power and as compared to the very moderate and progressive group of women, for instance, who are upcoming through these women groups are also entering the political arena in Afghanistan. Similarly, where women liberation is seen as an area of success, this has also made women activists prime target by the war protagonist. In last 2 years, we have seen a systematic assassination of leaders, women leaders, either in government, police, or civil society, who has been targeted and killed in different provinces. In most discourses, we repeatedly hear of peace. And I would, in conclusion, say that in most recent discourses, we hear the notion of peace and settlement with some of the similar group as Taliban or other hardline groups in the new political policy debate in U.S. And this has been raising another concern among women because the achievements are large, but they're in a very fragile state. They hasn't reached the stage to be sustained if it could be hampered in this way. For instance, women don't know what will be, what are the these discussions, what are the, these talks, what are the agenda, what whether women's rights are taken in any consideration. Is there any protection for the constitutional right that women has achieved in Constitution of 2004? So these concerns are bringing worries, and from time to time, women groups has gathered and are asking for being part of the peace negotiation, but also asking international community and Afghan government to make sure that women's rights shouldn't be compromised in these discussions. On the other hand, I would say that foreign aid is a necessity in Afghanistan, especially where we are dealing with such a scarce resources. 70% of the population is living under poverty. So a development project that voices the needs of the marginalized groups, such as women in traditional society, is very critical at this point. However, aid used as political tool in order to legitimize military intervention is compounding the challenges for self-growing, credible women activism and empowerment. Political motivated aid changes has enhances cultural hinders for women. And the successful, where we need that the successful models and projects which has been worked out in last few years, that there should be building up on those successes, and more projects should be developed which helps fostering this self-growing movement which is just emerging in Afghanistan. And the last, I would say that a short-sighted policy can win quick results. However, in the long run, drastic changes can hamper trust between U.S. And Afghans in general and women in specific, because each time after the Cold War, when women and Afghanistan was left as it is, and regimes like Taliban has come into power, if once again this happened, I think the way that Afghan women may not be looking to Americans or U.S. as a liberator of their rights, but they're certainly looking for them as a supporter of the women's rights. So this kind of trust and relation can be harmed in the long run. Thank you.
Dan has asked me to say a word about interfaith dialogue, particularly where the initiative has come from Muslim leaders. And interfaith dialogue has become a growth industry, particularly since 9/11, and a great deal of initiative has been taken by Muslim leaders to reach out to, particularly to Christians and Jews. Probably the most significant initiative is what's called the Common Word. This was a document which was published in 2008. The brains behind it were the King of Jordan and Prince Ghazi of Jordan, gathered together 138 Muslim intellectuals and clerics to draft this document. They called it the first initiative of its kind since the time of the Prophet to find common ground between Christianity and Islam. Every denomination of Islam was represented. Every Muslim-majority country was represented. Following the issuance of the Common Word in 2008, there have been large follow-up conferences at Yale, at Cambridge, the Vatican. The Pope received delegates to discuss the document. And just last week at Georgetown University, there was a large gathering focused on the Common Word and the implications for interfaith relations. The introduction to the Common Word says, "Never before have Muslims delivered this kind of definitive consensus statement on Christianity. The signatories have adopted the traditional and mainstream Islamic position on respecting the Christian scripture. Indeed, the most fundamental common ground between Islam and Christianity and the best basis for future dialogue and understanding is the love of God and the love of neighbor." And the whole document focuses on common understandings between Christianity and Islam. And while this is focused on the relationships between these two faiths, there have also been side discussions with Jews as well. Prince Ghazi has asked the U.S. Institute of Peace to help in developing materials that can be used at congregational levels, both in mosques and Christian churches, to draw out the implications of the common word for interfaith relations. Another very important initiative was the initiative by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia in 2008, a large event, interfaith event, a much broader event. It wasn't just Christians and Muslims, but Shiite, Sunni, Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, and Shintoists, a very significant outreach toward other religious communities. This was an event that was held in Madrid, and probably the most important aspect of this initiative was the fact that the most conservative regime and country and the Muslim, the World Muslim League were the initiators and sponsors of this event, and I think this will be followed up by other activities. Somewhat similarly, since 2002, there's been an annual Doha conference on interfaith dialogue. In 2008, there were 200 participants from 30 countries gathered together for this purpose. USIP has published an important book written by Muhammad Abu Nimer called Unity in Diversity, which is a description and an assessment of interfaith dialogue in four Middle Eastern countries, in Israel, Palestine, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and Egypt, and talking about the successes and failures of interfaith dialogue in those places, and an assessment of how interfaith dialogue can be more successfully pursued in the future. One case that is discussed there is the so-called Alexandria process. In the summer of 2001, Rabbi Menachem Froman, chief rabbi of the Tekoa settlement in the West Bank, and Sheikh Talal Sidr, who was the chief sheikh in the Palestinian Authority cabinet, came to us and asked if we would host a gathering for them to issue a religious declaration of peace between Israel and Palestine. And unfortunately, it didn't happen because Prime Minister Sharon vetoed the participation of the rabbis, and in its wisdom, the State Department denied a visa to Sheikh Talal Sidr to come to this country, even though he was a chief promoter of peace from the Palestinian side. But then the Archbishop of Canterbury picked this initiative up, and there was a meeting in January of 2002 in Alexandria, Egypt, and the participants were religious leaders, very prominent religious leaders, Jews, Christians, and Muslims from Israel and Palestine, that issued the Alexandria Declaration. And since that time, USIP has been the principal financial supporter of the Alexandria process and its follow-up meetings. The plan was to establish a religious peace process which would parallel and reinforce the political peace process. Unfortunately, the political peace process never got off the ground, and so the Alexandria process, in a sense, was stillborn. On the other hand, it created relationships across religious boundaries that had been tense and conflictual for many years, but these relationships persist and are in place once the peace process gets well established. In Iraq, the parliament, the Council of Representatives, has asked USIP to help them form a Center for Interfaith Dialogue and to hold workshops in Iraq to bring together a wide range of the religious diversity in Iraq to talk about how interfaith relations can be improved. And we are working with the Iraq Council of Representatives to establish that Center for Interfaith Dialogue. In 2008, the Islamic Society of North America and the Union of Reformed Judaism jointly produced a dialogue guide between Jews and Muslims for use in mosques and synagogues. In November of 2007, the Foundation for Ethnic Understanding in New York organized the first national summit of imams and rabbis. It was held in New York Synagogue and the Islamic Cultural Centers. These efforts sometimes have been criticized for being too elitist and at too high a level, but there are enhanced efforts to bring this down to congregational level so that interfaith dialogue is not just a discussion among elites, but among congregants in mosques and synagogues and churches.
Well, first I'd like to thank all the panelists for very excellent presentations. Just got a note saying that Congressman Ellison has arrived. So I think this is a good point to take a little break and just to get the congressman in for his, and we'll have the discussion afterwards and questions, which I'm sure there'll be lots of, to the panelists. Okay.
Don't go too far, because the congressman
he's coming
is right,
in right
outside
now,
the
folks.
Door.
He's so. Right here.
Good morning. I know you've been hard at work already and hearing some good stuff, and the morning will continue, but we're extremely pleased that Congressman Keith Ellison, who represents Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, can join us. He's someone who follows the issues we're discussing this morning very closely. Let me just make one comment about this terrific book that we've just published. One of the interesting qualities about our engagement with the world is we usually get pulled in or jump into some problem, and then we study it, and then we develop public dialogue and some understanding of what we're all caught up in. And that is very much the case, I think, with what we're wrestling with today in Iraq, Afghanistan, AFPAC, and other developments in the Muslim world. 9/11, of course, was an event that changed our whole national agenda. We didn't really pay attention with the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 93 and then the attacks on our embassies in Africa. 9/11, again, got everybody's attention. And we here at the Institute started at that point a Muslim World Initiative. The reaction of some of our folks was, well, why do they hate us so much? Why were they attacking us? And with this book points out is how much more complex the set of issues that underlie the turmoil in the Muslim world, what's going on in these various countries where we have troops in harm's way, where we as a country and we at the Institute of Peace are working to try to stabilize countries that are really gripped with very intense ethnic and religious tensions, all the things that I don't need to go off into. But again, Dan Brumberg, we got too many Dans around here, and Dina Shahada are due tremendous credit. This was a project that started a number of years ago, and as I said, in the spirit of us finally getting our act together and developing understanding, and then through the work of the Institute trying to promote public dialogue on the complex issues that our policymakers are wrestling with, even though there's this time lag. I think this book is a tremendous contribution. So I want to express my appreciation to our colleagues and to Congressman Ellison for being with us today. And I know your discussion is going to continue to be interesting. Thank you, Abby.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm really honored to be here and very gratified that all of us have been able to come together to discuss what I think is a critically important topic, and that is how do we put flesh on the bone of this vision that our president has articulated, this new way forward with the Muslim world based on mutual respect, mutual interest. I think it's all of our business, and it's an important topic, and I'm honored to be able to address it today. But before we jump into the topic, let me thank the United States Institute of Peace. It's a tremendous institution dedicated to discovery of how we can live together. It's a great mandate, mission, and action. And so I thank the Institute of Peace and all of the people who support it and work here, including our president. Thank you, Ambassador Mr. Richard Solomon. It's wonderful to be here. And congratulations on your building. It's looking good. And I can't wait to be there when it's fully equipped. Also, let me thank Mr. David Smock, today's commentator, for all his work at USIP on religion and peacemaking. It's very important. I think that the whole country, perhaps world, benefit from your work, and I encourage you to continue. Thank you. Let me also congratulate USIP and editors Daniel Brumberg and Dina Shahata for their book, Conflict, Identity, and Reform in the Muslim World. The book is a very important contribution to the dialogue. And, of course, in order to arrive at the right prescription, we need to have the right diagnosis, and your book helps us to get there. Thank you. Thank you very much for your work. And as back to where we are now. The president, I think, broke absolute new ground when, in his inaugural speech, only 18 minutes long, he said that we needed a new way forward. He's absolutely right, for reasons I'm sure he's aware of. A new way forward clearly implies that that we were operating under an old way, and I think that that's exactly right. Quite frankly, I think that in many ways, our country, the United States, is still grappling with how to understand our role in the world in a post-Soviet period. So often the world was divided between poles. Soviet bloc, the West, led by the United States. And in those days, countries that were not wealthy industrialized nations often found themselves trying to figure out whose side they were to be on. And whose side you were on would determine how aid might flow, assistance, arrangements, international arrangements, and things like that. And these relationships were set. And, of course, we do emerge from that period, before that, from a colonial period. And these things help shape the present circumstances that we're in, because I think that researchers could probably support me in this proposition, that what we see today as violent extremism with a Muslim veneer is essentially a post-colonial reaction and a glomming onto an ideology that can unify a group that fundamentally finds their inspiration not from Quran, Hadith, and Sunnah, but from the political environment rooted in grievance, and thereby making the case that violent action, transnational violent action is what they need to solve their problem. If you look at the theorists who are responsible for what we would regard today as violent extremism with what I call a Muslim veneer, people like Said Qutb, Egyptian writer, who basically wrote at a time when Egypt was emerging from that colonial period and coming up in a period that was highly identified by the global competition between the West and the Soviet bloc. And so his ideology, in my view, is shaped by that. And in his original political thinking was not around religion. In fact, Egypt at that time in the 40s and 50s was a fairly secularized state. But then this group essentially attached itself to religion and used it as a unifying political force, which ripened into what we see today, bin Ladenism, al-Qaeda, things like that. So our response to this phenomenon has to be designed to address the fundamental issues involving a globalizing world in which many parts of it have yet to benefit from the economic and cultural and social benefits that can derive from an increasingly interconnected economic system. And a society that feels on the margin, that has reason for feeling that way, and yet in that environment of feeling marginalized, some individuals will choose the most destructive, least humane ways of trying to resolve conflict. And so that is, I think, what exploded on September 11th, 2001. Antisocial, violent terrorists who essentially, pointing to points of historic grievance, trying to engage the United States in a long series of conflict, which that I believe they ultimately thought would drain us and divert us and then cause us to overreact and thereby bring the larger Muslim world into the conflict. They would like to expand the conflict. They would like to make it into a religious conflict, not a political one, not a social one, not an economic one, but to expand it. And so I believe that our general strategy should be to expand friends and isolate irreconcilable enemies. But expanding friends requires us to very deliberately do that. Expanding friends, and I think Barack Obama put his finger absolutely on the point that we need to be pushing on by saying we need a new way forward based on mutual respect and mutual interest. A new way forward, not in the old way, not a post-colonial world, not a post-Soviet world, not a client-patron world, not a donor-donee world, based on just rewarding friends and punishing those that aren't. But a world, a new world, in which development is used to actually develop. A new world in which we see each other in a broader context than extractive economics and counterterrorism. A broader world than that. A world that is fully fleshed out in terms of all aspects of human relationship. A new way forward based on mutual respect and mutual interest. I was excited when he said those words, and even more excited when he quickly appointed George Mishal to be the envoy to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Richard Holbrooke to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I was even more excited when he gave his speech in Ankara, where he said the United States is not now nor never has been at war with Islam. I think that is an accurate statement. I think that it's right, and I think that it's important for a president to say so. And I was pretty much tickled pink when he gave that speech in Cairo. Thought it was phenomenal. And I my biggest question was, well, how did he think of this? You know, I mean, I had been feeling it. I had been saying much of it. But I was just so impressed that a president of the United States, leader of the free world, would make these statements, would go to a university in Egypt, not to the seat of government in Egypt, but to the youth, to the institutions that symbolize youth, the university setting, the place where ideas are exchanged, and offer these very excellent and I think insightful remarks. The problem is, well, no. Before I get to the problem, let me say one more good thing. The words are important. Messaging is important. Language is very important. relationships are set by what we say. Relationships are often the trajectory of where they go is set by what we say in this moment. And the fact is that, you know, he set a message that I think resonated. I was in the Middle East at the time, and I was and I felt and it was palpable to me that his message was ringing in a very, very favorable way. I also was in Africa in August and in Kenya, of all places. And there people, I mean, he could clearly be the president tomorrow if he wanted to of Kenya. But in Sudan, where the United States has had sanctions on that government and has taken some fairly firm positions with regard to that government. I heard people in the government in Khartoum and in in Juba, which is the seat of government in southern Sudan, both speak very positively about what prospects might lie ahead. And I think the other more encouraging thing that I heard was that people were not really sounding like they saw Obama as some sort of messiah, but saw that the new language created new opportunities for individuals to act in a way that could express their talent, their ability, and their ability to solve problems. So that's what I regard as the good news. Now let me get to the problem is that that we need the president needs some wins. We haven't had enough wins yet. I don't think it's because of lack of effort. I do think the president deserved his Nobel Peace Prize by setting the tone that he set, really opens up opportunities for so many. But I will say that I think we need some wins. I think the challenges are before us. There's no doubt about it. We need to see some wins. Let's start talking about how we might achieve some wins and what some of the challenges are by understanding that the Muslim world is larger than the Arab world. Not all Muslims are Arabs. Not all Arabs are Muslim. The largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. I believe the second is probably India. Maybe I could be corrected on that. Pakistan is close by. Nigeria has about 78 million Muslims. And before you get to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they're actually pretty far down the line. The United States, by the way, has more Muslims than many countries that are considered Muslim countries. I'm very confident the United States has more Muslims than Kuwait or Jordan or Maldives, or there's probably a long list. And so it's important to understand, excuse me, that the Muslim world is broader than the Arab world, although we think of the Muslim world as the Arab world because the Quran is in Arabic. The Prophet Muhammad received revelation in the Arab world, and so much of that is captured within Arab culture and language. But it's important to also note that the Prophet himself said, no Arab is better than a non-Arab, and no non-Arab is better than an Arab. No black is better than a white. No white is better than a black. In fact, the Quran says that the best of you is the one who's closest to his duty. And that is what, and it's clearly said in juxtaposition to issues of tribe, color, culture, nation, things like that. So this is an important thing for us to bear in mind and know as Americans. It's also important to remember that the United States, as I just alluded to, is part of the Muslim world. The United States is part of the Muslim world. And how our country interacts with the Muslim world must incorporate how religious minorities, in this case the Muslim religious minority, are treated within the United States. Two-thirds of the Muslim population within the United States is foreign-born and may be one of the most diverse Muslim populations in the world, rivaled only by the UK and other parts of Europe where people immigrate. You can go into the masjid that I go to on Fridays when I'm home in Minneapolis, and you will find people of all descriptions. You'll find people who are as white as the moon. They might be from Kosovo or Russia or the United States. A lot of converts who are of European descent, American born for generations. People like Hamza Youssef, Sohaib Webb, respected religious authorities who converted to Islam, and you will find people whose complexion speaks to Africa, as deep and dark a complexion as you find anywhere in the world, and you could find people from everywhere in between. Indonesia, Malaysia, the Far East, China, everywhere, 40 million Muslims in China. This is important to understand, and this is in the United States. This is not, I'm not speaking about the world abroad at this point. I'm talking about the diversity here. And while all these communities share a faith, they do not share necessarily language, culture, or tradition. This is very important to see. And if you go abroad for a moment and you just take a look at Hajj, you see this rich diversity in Mecca during this period of time. So it's important to understand that you know one Muslim's not like another Muslim. They're very different. In some Muslim countries, women, they do nearly everything that men do, and the level of sexism is comparable to what you would see in the United States. And in other places, you have gender apartheid, where women aren't even allowed to drive car. I actually had a friend who was killed in a car accident in Saudi Arabia. And when I went to see him a few months after his death, I was speaking with his wife, who's the same age as I am, and she was telling me how she couldn't wait till her 17-year-old son turned 18 so that he could sign documents finalizing his property arrangements because her signature wasn't quite good enough. So that's just an anecdote, and I don't want to generalize, but I just wanted to set the stage like that. I want to applaud the Obama administration for including Muslim Americans like Farah Pandit, who was a special representative for Muslim communities at the Department of State, and others. American Muslims can benefit from working with the government and must. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But let me say that I think that there are things that the Muslim world should do, including in the United States, and there are things that we as Americans need to continue to do. And let me just say that the outreach is the first step, and understanding is one of the original and initial steps. But there are things that we should do, and these things will not be easy. In many ways, the most difficult part of getting a car moving, if anybody has ever had their car stuck in the snow, what's the hardest part? Getting it out of the snow. Once you get it rolling, it's easier, right? Well, we're in the beginning, right? We're in the beginning. We're getting that car out of that rut, and we're trying to do that, and it's not that easy. The president has helped give a big shove with this language that he has used, and I thank him for that, as I mentioned before. But there are things that we need to take in consideration, and these things I think should be obvious. It's when we signal that we're going to have a new way forward based on mutual respect and mutual interest, we have to understand the implications of things like the security of civilians in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. When drone strikes are killing 10 civilians to one militant, this is not the message we want to convey. We have to change our policy to be much more concerned about the welfare of civilians, because when you kill a civilian, you literally recruit people who were not part of the fight into it for no other reason than family loyalty and basic human action. We have increased since 2007 drone attacks about 12-fold. About 60 drone attacks between August 2007 and 2008. And yet we have not impacted the number of suicide attacks in Pakistan. They're about level. So as we are increasing our drone attacks, we don't seem to be impacting this serious problem of terrorism within Pakistan. I'm sensing that we might not be pursuing the right strategy here, and we need a real rethink. And we have to ask ourselves, what are the implications for messaging to the Muslim world when we say we want a new relationship, but we're pursuing this policy that, in my opinion, is somewhat iconic of the moment that we're in now? Our rhetoric has changed, but we have got to really think about how we align what we say with what we do. I will say that I thought it was unfortunate that there have been reports that the United States and has been part has tried to influence the Palestinian Authority not to have a full hearing on the Goldstone report. Now, let me just tell you, I'm a supporter of Israel. I am. I think Israel is an important country. It's our ally. And I also know that the United States has seen Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, Jim Crow, all types of problems. Our country has faced tremendous challenges to what we say we believe in, and yet we still stand. Don't be afraid of a report that might reflect something unflattering about our ally. It won't hurt them. It may strengthen them. It may demonstrate a resolve to the and commitment to the truth, and then give an opportunity to move forward. It would be, I think, a good thing. Richard Goldstone, people hasten to say that, well, he describes himself as a Zionist Jew. That's not his most important qualification. His most important qualification is that he is a respected jurist emerging from apartheid in South Africa and post-apartheid South Africa, and dealt with war crimes in places like Kosovo and Rwanda. He knows what he's doing. He's highly respected, and it will not hurt us to shine the sun on these very, very serious issues. And in fact, will give greater confidence that there's transparency and a willingness to look within. And I think our government's policy should be to support what Ban Ki-moon says, which is, let's follow the leads where they lead. I think this is very important, and I know it's not. I know some people will disagree with me with this, but I still it's what I believe is true. I think that it's also important for the United States to really step back and look into how we do foreign assistance reform. We cannot use aid and development the way we use it in the past. A lot of scholars will say that we really haven't done much for, say, Africa. With all the over $1 trillion we've dumped in Africa, how much better is Africa because of our aid? And I think there's arguments to be made that we haven't been effective. Now, that's not everywhere. No doubt about it. The $600 million that we have put into to fight AIDS in places like Kenya have done a tremendous amount of good. This has helped all populations in Kenya, including the Muslim population. So I don't think it's a total failure, but I will say that the way we do foreign aid is important, not only how we relate to the Muslim world, but to the whole world, and the Muslim world is a large part of that poor section of the world that could benefit from a more effective, more deliberate aid policy, which is more grassroots-based, which listens to local people on the ground, which does not allow donors to put condition after condition, but is strict in terms of anti-corruption and effective outcomes. But you know what? The Muslim world has a lot to do itself. Absolutely. The Muslim world has much to do. One of the things the Muslim world needs to do is to stop looking at itself through the prism of colonialism and Soviet era politics. Because I think the Muslim world often sees itself as a victim of the events in the world. And I think that all economies in the world need to say that colonialism in the Soviet era have ended, that we have to view ourselves as a global community, and simply aligning the world in terms of oppressors and the oppressed isn't useful for people who need real outcomes today. And I think this is very important, and I think that it's not easy to say, because clearly, people being in the role of the oppressed is often far more comfortable than the other position, and people don't want that role because it requires responsibility. But I think it's important that the Muslim world look at this the world we're walking into in terms of being empowered, in terms of what it can do, and in terms of how it can serve its population the best. Let me say, women's rights are a critical issue that must be addressed. I believe you cannot have an educated population and an uneducated female population. I don't think those two things can exist at the same time. And I think that if you look at the example of Khadija and Aisha, who, well, Khadija was the wife of the Prophet and was his boss, was 15 years his senior, employed him. How, with her example, would you suppress a woman's ability to earn income and deny her the right to go out there and seek her fortune? You see, the Muslim world doesn't need to import imagery. It's there already. Aisha, who was a wife of the Prophet, was the most respected reporter of hadith, which is sayings of the Prophet. If you have Muslim men today who would walk out of the mosque if a woman stood up to teach them. But are those same men saying that they wouldn't listen to Aisha tell them what the Prophet said? This is very important to think about. There is change that needs to happen. And it needs to happen at a pace that makes real sense. It's important that Muslim communities around the world have greater respect for minorities. The Shia, historically, over the last 50 years, have been suppressed in majority Sunni countries. I say this as a Sunni Muslim. We've got to reconcile these issues. But yet, I hear reports that in Iran, it's not that good to be a Sunni Muslim nowadays. These are things that we have to confront head on. The rights of minorities. And other issues need confrontation as well. Things like gay rights have to be confronted within the sphere not of approval, but of allowing God to judge who will be judged, and not inflicting harm or persecution on people because what your opinion of them is. These are basic respect rights for individuals that I think the Muslim world needs to take a very difficult and strong look at. The issue of just freedom of expression. There are Muslim countries where the majority of the population is Muslim, where a Muslim must wear hijab or she will be in violation of law. And there are Muslim countries where she must not wear hijab or she will be in violation of law. This is a case where I feel comfortable offering the American model. Wear what you want. That's your business. I think it's important that, and this again is another example of where Islam does not need to borrow from another culture, but just needs to look within itself to see what's there. In the Quran, it says clearly, there's no compulsion in religion. Truth stands free from falsehood. No compulsion in religion. It should say, well, it says what it says, and it should say what it does say, but it could say, it could be interpreted also to mean not only should Muslims not compel non-Muslims and not the other way around either, but people who have different understandings of Islam within the faith should be respected for what God has shown them. And let me also move on and say that the Muslim world, particularly the Gulf states, I think, must step up on the issue of global poverty much more aggressively. This is a critical issue. Right across the Gulf, right across the Red Sea is Africa. Somalia, a Muslim country, been just spinning and spinning and spinning for over 18 years. When it has Muslim neighbors all around it, you would think that the Muslim world could step forward and say, we're going to bring and facilitate a process of stability and peace. I think this is fair to ask the Muslim world to do. And in areas like Sudan, where there's longest civil war in Africa, where right now you have a situation where if the Southern Sudanese could vote to secede, they would. I'm sure that's true. What is the Khartoum government doing to make unity attractive? Because let me tell you, once African countries start saying, you know, that border is an artificial colonial imposed one, that opens up a can of worms I don't think anybody really wants open. Sudan needs to work to make sure that it does not split, because I think Southern Sudan will become a ward of the world and Northern Sudan will be far poorer for it. So let me just move on and try to wrap up my comments today by saying that within the United States, I think it's important for Muslim communities and non-Muslim communities, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, to encourage civic engagement from all Americans, but including Muslim communities. And what I mean by civic engagement is all of us need to stand together and say that that Muslim who is suing somebody because they think that they're aggrieved is operating within our system of civil redress, and that's a good thing. That Muslim who's voting, they're making a choice about their politics through the ballot box, and that's a good thing. That person running for office, that's a good thing. We should encourage civic participation of all Americans, not discourage it. And I think that this is a very positive development. Isn't what we want, isn't it the American way, not only the American way, but isn't it also our way to say, look, human conflict is absolutely guaranteed. We're not going to agree. We're not going to always get along. We're going to see things differently based on all the factors that make us unique. But we've set up systems where we can resolve conflict with no loss of life or injury to any person or their property. This is what we should be aiming for. And I think that we should encourage these things when we see them. And so I think that these are just a few of my ideas that I think that are essential for a better America, a better world, a better relationship between the United States and the Muslim world. My ideas, again, just in quick summary, a broader prism than just counterterrorism and extractive industry. Encouragement of minority rights within the Muslim world through a humble process, through example, not imposition. Encouraging the United States to look at how our policy is now misaligned with the stated policy of our government and to bring those things into harmony. I think if we do these things and we keep writing good books as you produce, and if we continue to work hard and we work patiently, that we will find ourselves in that new way forward that the president articulated. And I think that it'll be a good thing. Thank you very much. Oh, I got to go vote. I'd love to take a few questions, but we got floor in 15 minutes. Okay, one question's here. Just one. Yes, sir. Well, let me tell you, that's a good question. It's a very broad question, and I'm fearful that I won't be able to answer within the time allowed. But I'll leave you to contemplate the question. I can tell you this, that I represent the district with the largest percentage of Somali Americans in the whole country. There are more Somalis in my district than there are in Toronto, Virginia, anywhere, Seattle, anywhere. And I can tell you that while I respect your view, and I really do, that a large percentage of Somalis in my district were encouraged by Sheikh Sharif Ahmed, and that, yes, it's true that he was one of the people of the Islamic Courts Union, but it's also true that that was a period where many Somalis remember there was peace in Mogadishu. And so I'll leave the more complex and nuanced positions to be explored by others, but I have to go vote because that's my job. Thank you all very much.
Well, even though, of course, the congressman was unable to take more questions, we have five panelists here who I'm sure will be happy to take any more questions you have. So you can just come up to the microphone and just identify yourself.
My name is Soumi Venkatesh. I'm a research associate for the Public International Law and Policy Group. First of all, I want to thank all of you for your speeches. It was very informative. I actually have a question for you, Mr. Tespina, about the role of Turkey in the Middle East. I wanted to ask more about Turkey becoming an inadvertent model for the Middle East, especially how, I was wondering if you could expand on that, especially seeing other states, seeing Turkey being close to the U.S. and the EU, but still being run by an Islamic party. What will that do to the rise of moderate Islamicism in the Middle East, and so forth?
You can right there if you prefer, or up front, what's your preference?
Here. Lazy. Thank you. It's a good question. And there is definitely a more ambitious political party in power in Turkey today. The AK Party, Justice and Development, has a vision of Turkey as a regional power. And it doesn't want to, like the previous political parties of Turkey, put all Turkey's eggs in one basket, the European Union and the NATO basket. It wants to have a regional policy of engagement with all the neighbors, including Armenia. Now, as you have recently seen, the president of Armenia was in Turkey yesterday in the framework of what came to be called the soccer diplomacy. And there is a rapprochement now between Turkey and Armenia. Turkish-Greek relations are much better. Turkey's relations with Syria are experiencing a renaissance now. Just 10 years ago, the two countries came at the brink of war because of the PKK, the Kurdish terrorist organization. Now Syria has become one of the supporters of Turkey in the region, and Turkey played a role up until recently in the Israeli-Syrian peace talks negotiations. So this is a political party that actually, as you framed, wants to play a more active role in the region. It's, and I think part of its attraction to other countries, part of this Turkish model that is emerging, is that it is able to pursue good relations with both the United States and Europe and the regional countries, including Russia. So it's a high-wire balance acting very often. And there will be tough times coming. If there is a sanction regime against Iran, what will Turkey do? I mean, that's a big question. Now, Turkey is in the United Nations Security Council, a group of 10 countries that are rotating, and Turkey will have to vote whether it wants sanctions or not in case that vote comes. So there will be times where Turkey's ability to engage in this kind of high-wire balance acting will be tested. But overall, I think the political party in power has done a good job of pursuing EU membership, trying to maintain good relations with the United States, and regional engagement. One exception to this, unfortunately, has been relations with Israel, as I mentioned in my talk. And that is a product of the growing importance of public perception, public opinion in Turkey. And I think the current government, I'm reluctant to call it an Islamic party, really, because more than an Islamic party, it definitely has Islamic roots. It is a populist political party. It is a political party that reflects the opinions of the people in Turkey. And in that sense, yes, there is an elite in Turkey that is still very pro-Israel, very secularist, and wants basically nothing to do with the Arab world, but the growing majority of Turkey is very pro-Palestinian and has been appalled with the war in Lebanon and what happened to Hamas in Gaza. And that was visible in the way Erdogan dealt at Davos with the panel, the way he basically stormed out of the room because he was angry with Shimon Peres and the moderator, David Ignatius. It's also visible now in the fact that Turkey canceled Israel's participation to an air force operation in Turkish territory. It was going to be a NATO operation, and Israel was going to participate. That was canceled last minute. So there are problems. It's not a very rosy picture, especially as far as Israel is concerned.
Hi, my name is Jason Stern, and I work for the Project on Middle East Democracy. My question is for Dina. You said that external forces need to support moderate voices in Egypt. And my two questions is, one, how is America doing so far in supporting moderate voices in Egypt? And two, moving forward, how do we do so while avoiding the quote-unquote Made in USA sticker that we've seen in Turkey? Thank you.
I think you're right. You know, this is the eternal problem that groups that get external support are sometimes also suffer negative consequences from such support. But sometimes it's really about supporting institutions rather than individuals. Perhaps that could be an approach. I think perhaps the problem with Ayman Noor, for example, as a case in point, or Saadeddine Ibrahim, it became very much about these particular individuals rather than perhaps, you know, the political party or the movement that they lead or represent. So perhaps one way to do so is to take a more institutional rather than individual approach. I think also focusing on youth and younger activists rather than, you know, particular prominent figures might be helpful. And already there's a lot of that that's been taking place over the past few years. I know a lot of delegations of Egyptian activists have been coming to Washington to participate in various activities, and I think it's been a useful engagement, and I think it should continue. But I think, you know, it's also important. I find that the whole discourse about engaging Islamists as a distinct group is not always very positive. I think it should be more about engaging, you know, moderate activists from various segments of the opposition, Islamist or otherwise, because there are moderate voices within the Islamist camp, and there are radical voices within the secular camp. So it's really about, you know, the cutting across the various ideological divides. Thank you.
Let me just add, for purposes of full disclosure, that USIP is supported POMED, and we've been involved in a series of these discussions, one recently in Amman, one about to happen in Beirut, and another one that we'll be participating in Cairo, which brings together these new kinds of leaders. And one of the things we've tried to do in these discussions is not identify, well, you're in the Islamist camp, you're in the secular camp, but to bring leaders together who want to talk about a different kind of future for Egypt. Now, of course, in part, this is about their own dialogue, and because those divisions exist. But there's a kind of commonality, one would hope, of sort of expectation or desire to think beyond the sort of boundaries of the Egyptian political inheritance, which is one in which you'll see extraordinarily. For many years, I tell you, I studied in Egypt and was a student at Cairo University in the 80s. And we are only beginning to see in the last 4 or 5 years a transference of leadership within the main political organizations. It's extraordinary. But this is an opportunity, a moment that has emerged for these sorts of new leaders to not only talk to us, but to talk to themselves.
Joseph Marcus with Citizens for Global Solutions. Dr. Tasbinar, you mentioned how in Turkey it's becoming more nationalized, less Islamized. Does that create less fractionalization, and would that then be easier later on to for the U.S. to engage with political parties that are more nationalized?
Mm-hmm. You're right in the sense that nationalism overall unites Turks. I think if there is one issue on which both the Justice and Development Party and the opposition and the Turkish military would all agree is that they feel frustrated with the way Turkey has been treated by the European Union. And this is a dangerous trend because it pushes, for the lack of a better word, let's call them the Islamists, towards a more Islamic option, to say we have to engage more with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with the Muslim neighbors, and there is no future for Turkey in Europe. And for the secularists, it creates basically this frustration because they perceive the Islamists as too pro-West. And that's a very big irony in Turkey. For instance, the Islamists are perceived too pro-American, too pro-EU, too much willing to accept these European terms because they believe that this Western trajectory of Turkey would protect them against the Turkish military. That kind of pro-Western democratization would protect them against the Turkish military. They perceived as basically too subservient to American and European Union demands. So on the one hand, yes, it unites these political parties in their frustration, but on the other hand, it kind of fuels the conspiracy theories about who's more pro-Western, who's reluctant to keep really the Turkish nationalist flag, and there's still a degree of polarization. And of course, the bigger threat is the threat to Turkish democracy in the long run. I don't think Turkish democracy can afford to totally alienate itself from the European Union. If there is no light at the end of the tunnel for Turkey-EU relations, I think the likelihood of a military intervention in Turkey, be it on the question of political Islam or confrontation with the Kurdish question, with the Kurds, that also is another identity problem that we didn't talk about much, but there is a second dimension of Turkey's identity issues, which is the Kurdish question. There, too, I think there would be more polarization because more Turkish nationalism begets more Kurdish nationalism, and there is a polarization. So the more I talk about it, the more I realize that actually Turkish nationalism may not unite everyone and may create more problems, especially on the Kurdish question. But there is this sense of frustration with the European Union and with the United States that we should, I think, consider, because there's too much focus on political Islam in Turkey and Islamization, not enough focus on this kind of nationalist frustration shared by both secularists and nationalists.
If I may just add a quick word to that, during the Bush administration, there was a real push to get Europe to agree for EU membership for Turkey, and there was a divergence. The Europeans, I think, felt justifiably that the Bush administration was rushing this along, desperate to have this thing succeed, because as you said, Omar, the Turkey was supposed to be the example of this successful Muslim, modern, pro-Western country, and it created this divergence. Now, X years later, we have to find a way of getting the West, the EU, and the United States on the same page, recognizing that each of us, for our own purposes, one resisted, other pushed it. And we didn't have a sense of the actual dynamics and what was feasible in terms of Turkish membership. So now perhaps there's an opportunity for Europe and the United States to address this challenge on the same page. But the Palestine issue is certainly complicating this question in the sense that as this escalates, Turkey's ability to play this role, because it was a peacemaker trying to intervene between Israel and the Palestinians and try to provide a path of discussion.
Can I give one example that shows that Europeans are frustrated with this, what they perceive as Islamization in Turkey? Turkey was the only NATO member that radically objected to the new Secretary General of NATO, Rasmussen, to become the NATO Secretary General because he was Prime Minister of Denmark during the Khartoum crisis. And Turkey said that at the time when NATO is operating at the heart of the Islamic world in Afghanistan, it's unwise to have a Prime Minister of a country that was associated with the Khartoum crisis. And that totally alienated even supporters of Turkey within the European Union on the grounds that Turkey is becoming the voice of the Islamic world, and this is not the Turkey that they want to talk to. They want to talk to a team player, a country that is more secular and would not be willing to voice the Islamic world's opinion at these NATO European settings.
The final question.
Thank you very much. Onur Sazak with Hudson Institute. Dr. Klashmer, it's good to see you again. I would like to ask you to find out your comments about a recent Pew poll that showed that there's an increase in the number of Turkish public who think that Islam and Turkish democracy is not compatible. And this increase is compared to a 2007 poll, which is about 40%. It may not be much. But do you think this is an unintended consequence of AKP? Because you are making the argument that what's going on in Turkey has very little to do with identity, Islamist versus secularist. But then how do we explain this increase in the public opinion?
Yeah, I'm not 100% familiar with the opinion poll you cited, but overall, it is a polarized country, and there are lots of people in Turkey who have a orientalist frame of mind in the secularist camp, especially arguing that Islam and democracy cannot be compatible. Therefore, if this political party is of an Islamist party, it will never become a democratic party, pro-democracy party. And the party, on the other hand, argues that it is the secularists who are becoming increasingly anti-democratic, willing to have a military coup or a judicial coup, closing the party, and that, in fact, they are the ones who are increasingly turning against the European Union because they're frustrated with the Islamists' willingness to abide with these democratization packages. What they fear is that too much democracy in the long run will create too much Islam in the country, and that's the dilemma. That basically if you continue democratization, if people want a more Islamic regime, you will end up with an Islamic regime. So this is very relevant for the dynamics of the Islamic world, for the larger dynamics of the Islamic world. How can you convince the secularists, the people who are skeptical are concerned about the rise of Islam, that more democracy will not lead to more Islamization?
Well, to thank our panelists for their observations and to thank you for coming and for your questions. To thank, of course, in absentia, Congressman Ellison for his wide-ranging remarks. And, of course, to encourage you to buy copies of the book and to read it. So thank you very much for coming.